Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Thanksgiving in America has become a time for overladen tables, football, the Macy's parade, and preparations for a frenzy of Black Friday shopping. This year's holiday gatherings? A lot different, of course. But how did we get here? How did the United States finally embrace a nationwide day of gratitude? Our ideas about Thanksgiving are ever evolving. Now, a new book from author Denise Kiernan breaks open our ideas of the holiday and its origins. It's called We Gather Together, A Nation Divided, A President in Turmoil, and a Historic Campaign to Embrace Gratitude and Grace. Kiernan is the author of The Last Castle. It's an instant New York Times bestseller. And The Girls of Atomic City, a New York Times and NPR bestseller. And she's joining us today to talk about her latest book. Welcome, Denise. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I want to start with Sarah Hale. This is a story about this writer and editor. And most people are surprisingly familiar with her work because she's the author of a very famous children's poem. Tell us a little bit about how you were introduced to her.
It's actually hard for me to remember when I first came across Sarah Giuseppe Hale's story. She's one of those people who is you know, the stories about her and her writing and her relationship to Thanksgiving, you know, are here and there. And I remember the first time I came across her, I think I was actually working on another book, and sometimes you just come across things, and I do what I always do, which is create a file. You know, there's an idea file, and I keep all these different idea files about different kinds of people and things that I find curious that I might want to write about down the road. But I don't, as key a figure as she is in We Gather Together, I don't really write traditional biographies. So I knew I wanted sort of something else to kind of to come across before I decided to do something that Hale might figure into. And her, I often find myself drawn to sort of the intersection or juxtaposition of events and characters as much or more so than the individual events and characters themselves. Mm-hmm. And her intersection with so many people throughout the 19th century, from who were then unknown writers up through, you know, presidents, I found incredibly compelling. So the more I began to look into her and come across more of those intersections, as well as her role in Thanksgiving, I became more convinced there might be something here. And then finally, I was just looking at the idea of gratitude. Yeah. And, gratitude as, you know, sort of a compelling human instinct, something that's been on this planet and has been a global concept, you know, as long as humans have been around. And to me, that was kind of the linchpin for We Gather Together is in a way looking at the evolution, different aspects of American culture as seen through the lens of our relationship with giving thanks. And Hale is a central figure in that journey that we go on in the book.
And it's not really, you know, as I read it, I was taken with the fact of how much this idea of a national day of Thanksgiving means to her. It's not I'm going to sell magazines and therefore I need to, you know, pursue this idea. She's deeply invested in this. Why do you think it was so important to her to continually come back to this idea of gratitude and Thanksgiving?
You know, I like that you talk about that she, you know, it wasn't sort of like she was doing this to sell magazines, because, you know, she was such an influential editor and, you know, at the helm of what was one of the most, if not the most popular, magazine of the mid-19th century. And she used that pulpit to promote many things, Thanksgiving among them, but it was often used to not just to sell copies, it was to share passion projects and you know, not just Thanksgiving, but also, you know, various charitable causes and, you know, unheard of writers she thought needed promoting, or traditions she thought should catch on, or ideas about education, which was so important to her throughout her life, promoting education, especially for young women. The Thanksgiving fascination, and I think fascination is kind of putting it mildly with in Hale's case. You know, she was the daughter of a Revolutionary War veteran. Her father was injured fighting in the Revolutionary War. And, you know, she grew up in a house where the Union and these, you know, very, very new United States of America was a very important concept, you know, in her childhood and how she was raised. She had lived to see every president from Washington on until Washington through Hayes when she died. And, you know, so I think you take that kind of devotion to the concept of the Union and her ideas about, you know, wanting that Union not to get torn apart, because, you know, the further you get into the 19th century, the worse things are looking for the United States and its ability to stay together as we start heading into the Civil War. So I think you take that love for the Union and you sort of combine it with, you know, her family history and the fact that she grew up in New England, where, you know, Thanksgiving practices, you know, were around, and she clearly liked an overladen table. Mm-hmm. This was something that was, you know, very appealing to her. And I think those things combined into the idea that, you know, this holiday, we should have another national holiday. There were only two at the time, Washington's birthday and Independence Day. And, you know, what a unifying holiday that would be if everyone in the states and the territories and Americans abroad could come together on the same day every year and give thanks.
Speaking of that table, I'm going to read just a sentence or two from page 74, where she writes, "The roasted turkey took precedence on this occasion, being placed at the head of the table, and well did it become its lordly station, sending forth the rich odor of its savory stuffing and finely covered with the frost of the basin of the basting." And then there's beef, there's lamb, there's goose, there's...
Don't forget the goose and the ducklings.
Yeah. Just keeps.
And believe me, I only put in a small part of what she put in that chapter. I mean, this is on and on and on. Yeah.
Yeah.
She, currant wines and pickles and you know, how the table was set. And it's hilarious. Yeah.
And
the kind of thing as a writer you look at today, you think my editor would never let me get away with it.
No, but it has to be one of the earliest examples of food writing, of culinary writing that we have. I mean, this is pre...
Yes, and...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is 1827. She's writing this description. And, you know, she said that she called it, she said the description of a feast is a literary treat.
Yeah.
And, you know, she says, you know, she serves up her style to novel epicures, you know.
Yeah.
And it was really, I mean, this kind of description of that kind of feasting, and not just what was eaten, but, you know, the linens and the tableware and all of that sort of stuff, you know, incredibly indulgent and detailed. But you could actually see it, you know, coming out of the pages of, you know, Martha Stewart.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Martha Stewart, MFK Fisher, eat your hearts out. They probably knew her, you know, they'd be like, of course, she's inspiring to me. Okay. So I want to talk
about MFK Fisher. I bet probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk about the presidents, because I found this really, really fascinating. And I'm guessing that you did too, with, you know, from George Washington to John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, these early, you know, founding fathers. Here we're in South Dakota, you know, two of them are on the mountain and they had very different approaches. We think about them a lot here, and two of them had very different approaches, and some real hesitations about a national day of Thanksgiving.
Right.
Tell me about that.
That's right. So, you know, Thanksgiving has been around for a very long time. The word has been around for a very long time, certainly long before, you know, the United States was around. Washington was the first president to proclaim a national day of Thanksgiving. And it was the last Thursday in November when he did it. And it was a pretty quiet day. You know, businesses were closed. He himself, you know, went to the jail and gave some money so there could be some extra food and ale for, you know, the people who were imprisoned there. Adams, you know, followed suit, but did not do it on the same, doing it on the same day just wasn't something that was a thing yet. So he, you know, chose a different day, and his was, you know, fasting and humiliation. And days of fasting and humiliation, he was not the only one to ever declare those, but that was a very different sort of proclamation and message he was sending out. And one down the line, in a letter he wrote to a fellow founder, Benjamin Rush, he thinks probably did him in. You know, because it was too, you know, we made him viewed as, you know, too stern. And then Jefferson, who was, you know, a big believer in the separation between church and state, you know, recognized that, you know, days of Thanksgiving were both, could be secular or religious in nature. You know, it might be a Thanksgiving proclaimed for, you know, a battle of victory, or a Thanksgiving proclaimed for, you know, a more, you know, religious reason. And those sort of conflated with harvest festivals. But, you know, Jefferson wrote that, you know, he did not see this as something that a president should proclaim, because it was still so closely related. He viewed it as a religious practice, and he didn't mm-hmm. think that a president should proclaim any particular day that related to any kind of specific sort of, you know, religious practice, that should be left to religious leaders. So yeah, you have the first three presidents had very different interpretations of how they were going to proclaim or not proclaim, in Jefferson's case, nationally, the idea of Thanksgiving. And meanwhile, you know, in different individual states, you know, Massachusetts, New York, Connecticut, you know, places in the South, different, you know, Thanksgivings would be proclaimed by often, you know, the governors. And then, you know, they would, when you were having a Thanksgiving, might be in November in Massachusetts, it might be in, you know, December or October in New York or Connecticut. And so it was still very much, you know, left to the, left to the state authorities to do that, until we get back up to 1863 with Lincoln.
What is her connection? What is Sarah Hale's connection to Abraham Lincoln, and this, you know, this culmination of a quest to get a president to issue the kind of Thanksgiving proclamation that she believes this nation needs? Tell us a little bit about their relationship.
So they were not, Hale and Lincoln were not personal friends, although Hale's, and she, I could find no evidence that she ever met him, although it is possible she may have. I could find no evidence that she did. So her daughter's brother-in-law was a General Hunter who was very close with Lincoln. But Hale knew that if she wanted a national day of thanks, the kind of proclamation that Washington initially did, but for the entire United States every year on the same day, she had to get the authorities on her side. And she would write governors individually, trying to get them to all agree on the same day. She wrote ambassadors. She wrote the heads of territories. But she knew she needed to get a president on board. And so she writes Taylor and Pierce and Fillmore and Buchanan. And finally, she writes Abraham Lincoln and his Secretary of State, William Seward. And Seward, in his autobiography, you know, he says he went into Lincoln and said, you know, because this is in the middle of the Civil War, you know, they're saying we're trying to take away states' rights. I have another right we can take away from them, the right to name Thanksgiving. And Seward had already begun drafting a potential proclamation. He and Lincoln, you know, finished it up together. And Lincoln got on board. And that 1863 began the string of, you know, annual November Thanksgivings that we are familiar with today. And it, what's really lovely, and one of my favorite things about these sorts of books, is is the research, and you read the letter that she wrote to him, and it's so long. And, you know, she puts in clippings about how she, you know, this is what my magazine said about it. Like, she kind of had, like, she had her proof, you know, in there too. You know, we've got this many, you know, Ohio's governor, you know, has declared it on the same day every year. You know, people are, you know, joining my cause and all this sort of stuff. So I hope you will, you know, proclaim it as well. And he did. And he did.
All right. So for all the kids who grew up putting on a little pageant with pilgrim hats and really offensive scenarios of gathering together with Indigenous people welcoming. Okay, where'd that come from? How did that end up being part of a tradition that somehow made sense to somebody somewhere?
You know, and I grew up with all of that too. And I want to be, you know, clear that I am far from the first person to bring up the fact that the story a lot of us were told about 1621 and the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag Native Americans, that just isn't how that played out. There had been a number of, you know, quote unquote Thanksgivings proclaimed on the North American continent by various settlers when they came here and were thankful they, you know, had made it through a winter, this, that, and the other thing. You know, in Virginia, in La Florida, as it was called, when it was under Spanish rule, you know, Texas, Maine, you know, all over the place. Were the Pilgrims in Plymouth in 1621? Absolutely. Was there a meal that they shared with the Wampanoag? Yes, there was. But it pretty much ends there. There's no historical evidence that the Wampanoag were actually invited. There was no official proclamation or declaration of that as a Thanksgiving, which of course was the custom. You would proclaim, you know, Thanksgiving. And of course, you know, beyond that, you know, the relationship between the newcomers and the Indigenous peoples on this continent was not one that was, you know, certainly not a happily ever after by any, you know, reach of the imagination. So how does that take hold? Well, it starts, you know, in the media. And, you know, it was a very strong, the idea of Thanksgiving and Thanksgiving meals, you know, where Hale was from in New England was a very big idea. And because, you know, so many of the settlers who, you know, came to the United States, you know, came, you know, to the Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut area. And, but at some point in like the mid to late 19th century, you start to see these romanticized versions of early Thanksgivings. And one or two of them, one was in a book, a magazine called Our Young Folks, and another one, you know, was in Ladies' Home Journal. And these, and then a woman actually wrote a full-length novel, Standish on Standish, in which she described a fiction, in which she described, you know, a meal that there's no way, the things they served, there's no way it could have taken place. And it's exactly the kind of story we were told as kids. And these things start to take root. And, but what was interesting is when Hale, you know, approached Lincoln and all these presidents, she never once was set out to commemorate a specific day or event that had nothing to do with it. And in Lincoln's proclamation, he's not saying we're doing this because there was this, you know, first Thanksgiving. And, you know, as the 19th century moves on, there was a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment. And the idea of first Americans and real Americans, and, as opposed to people who were just coming over from these other countries, you know, a lot of people, you know, took to that. And, you know, a lot of these things just kind of dovetailed and gained steam. But, you know, definitely again, like women's magazines and young people's magazines became a part of that. Yeah.
There are other people waiting to talk to you about this really great book. So just before I let you go, what do you think the role of Thanksgiving in its ideal, if we wanted to hold it up to an ideal, what does it mean to America today?
I really do think, you know, the holiday has changed in so many ways. I think Hale would be, and Lincoln would be scratching their head at, you know, mm-hmm. football games and Black Friday sales and things of that nature. But I think one of the things that Hale certainly would be on board with is, you know, the Thanksgiving holiday over years has also become associated with charity and donations and Giving Tuesday and things of that nature. And I think there are some, you know, at its core, it is, you know, it is about giving thanks. And I think this year, because we have to pare down and hunker down and maybe, and, you know, not have the kinds of celebrations that we might be, you know, used to or want, we have this real opportunity to have a quieter, more purposeful, more kind of intentional holiday in a sense. You know, if you're not obligated to host 20 people, you can intend to communicate with folks maybe you don't always get to talk to over the holiday. Yeah. And because you're running around doing all of these other things. So I think that this year in particular, as hard as it is, and it's hard for all, this is rough this year. It's all the more important to find those things to stop and say thank you for. And the idea that we're all doing it on the same day, I think, is still a very powerful thing. Because, you know, right now, if you've got, you know, food on your table and a roof over your head and you don't have a virus, I mean, you've hit the jackpot. You're in pretty good shape.
The 2020 jackpot. The book is called We Gather Together. Denise Kiernan has been my guest. Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, and happy holidays.
So let's talk for a minute about mindset. Melissa Johnson is an author and certified speaker. She's a trainer with the John Gordon Companies, an entrepreneur and owner of Oh My Cupcakes, and she's a professional encourager. Well, she joined us last year with some actionable ways we can all make gratitude a part of our lives. Do you have practices, rituals? What are some easy ways to begin?
Oh my gosh, I love gratitude practices. There are so many that you could choose. I have a gratitude journal, and some people choose to write in their gratitude journal early in the morning. Some do it late at night. So some people say, as I'm waking up in this morning, these are the things that I'm grateful for right out of bed, right? And it kind of sets your mindset for the day. Some people at the end of the day like to focus on what went well throughout the day. But a gratitude journal, I think, is so important. Then when you're having a rough day or a rough week or a rough month, you can look back at that gratitude journal and go, wow, life really is pretty good. Look at all these good things. And okay, now here's the thing too, is I think that so many times when we're trying to practice gratitude, we can get stuck in saying, well, I'm grateful for my health and my family.
Right.
My health and my family. Those are the things I'm grateful for. I would challenge you to go a little bit deeper. Like I have in my gratitude journal, I am grateful for new socks. Like never underestimate the power of a brand new pair of cushy socks. Right. Like, but really being grateful for it is, that's what can set your mindset on a positive road.
November is a month of gratitude, but in the year 2020, practicing gratitude can be difficult. But remember, this isn't the first year we have experienced crises. Christy Nelson leads the Network for Grateful Living. She joined us last Thanksgiving with advice on how to practice gratitude during times of stress. You know, you're grateful for something because you've been through something and now it's over. Or you have a moment where all of a sudden you're faced with your own mortality and then you're grateful to be alive. But it goes away. It fades.
Yeah. You go right to cut to the chase, Lori. Yeah. I love that. I call those wake-up call moments.
Sure.
You know, when we get a wake-up call and face the possibility of the loss of our own life or the loss of something or someone we love. And those wake-up calls, we don't want them to fall on deaf ears. The goal would be to be awake to what we love and awake to the remembering that life is a gift all the time, so that it doesn't need to be brought about in some way that's like, oh my God, I just almost, you know, I just survived that terrible accident, you know, and I'm so glad to be alive. I'm going to go home and kiss my children and love my wife and be grateful for my job and, you know, the privileges that I have in my life. Well, where is that recognition and that awareness and that acknowledgement the rest of the time? So part of what we say is, can I be more awake in my daily life to gratitude for the fact that life is a gift all the time, even when we're struggling? It could be otherwise, right? So that we know that we're going to learn from things. And so can we be more aware in the moments that are hard? This is a learning opportunity, and I will be grateful for this. How can I go through this knowing that there is life on the other side of this challenging time? And that's a really important thing to remember. Our bad days are somebody else's good days.
Yeah.
You know, no matter who we are, no matter what we're dealing with, no matter, I had cancer and, you know, very advanced cancer, and my hardest days were somebody else's days that they might have dreamed of in a way because they're no longer alive or they suffered something that was more acute than what I did. And I think it's important for us to live inside a relative frame of reference, even when things are hard, to remember what are the privileges, what are the things that we don't want to take for granted about our life as it is, knowing that it could be otherwise. And so that's an important place to remember. And it actually really helps us sometimes bounce back and be present to life. It's like, oh yeah, I'm here. There's still opportunities in every single moment. And how do I not waste those?
How do we live in that relative frame of mind without shifting into a hierarchical or comparative frame of mind where, you've heard people like, well, I'm so grateful that, you know, even if, say, you're having a bad day, a fight with your spouse, I'm so grateful. At least I'm not divorced like the lady next door. Or, you know, how do you keep that sort of relativeness?
This is why I love talking to you, because you ask the best questions and you dive right in. So our experience of what we're grateful for, I think one of the things that's helpful for me to do is to remember, even when I'm struggling with things that feel like they're responsibilities or burdens in my life, that I compare it to what maybe what my grandparents would have imagined, right? Like, what would this have been like? It's not to compare to the person next door, because we don't want to objectify other people and look at other people and make ourselves better than because somebody else is necessarily suffering more. But it's more about knowing what in the universe of possibility, you know, what is working, to focus on what is working versus what's not working, I think is kind of a really good way to put it. It's so easy, and in our culture, we end up having conversations all the time about what isn't working. And I think it's not about taking those conversations away, Lori. It's about adding to the conversation. Yeah. So it's not just, I shouldn't be feeling this difficult feeling. I think it's also, what else is there for me to remember so that I can actually activate myself in some way toward love? It's not about a positivity or let's be optimistic all the time, but what unleashes our hearts? What makes us, what brings us to life? What allows us to still feel compassionate and generous about other people and towards ourselves? So one of the things that I think is important and that helps a lot for us is to remember the ways in which we are really blessed by things which we might feel are burdensome in the moment, but when they're gone, we recognize that they were real privileges. And that's kind of the wake-up call thing sometimes too, is, you know, we have people who are very connected to living gratefully who have had a house fire and lost absolutely everything that they owned. And then they realize that the things that they begrudged or complained about or neglected or what didn't appreciate in some way actually were incredible blessings in their lives. So It's about what do we take for granted, and I think we take a lot of our privileges and our good fortune for granted. It doesn't require comparing to anybody else.
It's likely that this year's Thanksgiving looks a bit different for you. Maybe you're having a small dinner in the garage, or you're going to the park with grandparents. Maybe there's an empty seat at your table this year. Perhaps you're moving the whole gathering online. But one thing can remain the same, the time you spend reflecting on what you have to be grateful for. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. The In the Moment team includes Josh, Steve Zwemke, Chris Loffrey, and me, Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.